Happy Thursday, everyone. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast Strength and Conditioning and Physical Therapy Podcast. My name is Adam Gray, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Dr. Ross Childs.
Happy Thursday. Glad everyone's back. We're getting a lot of great feedback again on our posts or our podcasts, so I'm glad to see more and more people are tuning in, and hopefully, again, we bring another good one to you today. We're going to start talking about strength training for runners. Adam and I have been talking about, you know, kind of seasonal sports that are coming up. And as it appears, winter is behind us, and now the warm weather's coming. More and more people are going to get outside. So really want to take some time and start offering up some helpful hints on strength training for runners, specifically this week. And then that'll morph into hikers because that's a different animal. But if there are any other sports or activities that you guys want to learn more about from a strength and conditioning standpoint or an injury prevention standpoint, always feel to reach out, and because we want to give you guys material that is helpful for you.
Yeah, and I think this is – running is something that we always, both of us, run into a lot. And that was not an intentional play on words. But – you know, we have people that come in, and you and I were kind of talking about this yesterday. You know, we have two sets of people. We have people that are coming in to strength train or something to help their running, and then, I mean, it's maybe a little bit more than two, and then, you know, we'll see some people that are like, oh, I'm having this issue because of running. Maybe that's more your speed. Somebody's coming in saying, I'm having pain when I run. What's going on?
Yeah.
You know, and so how are we approaching that? Because we both see plenty of that around here. And I'm sure that plenty of PTs and strength and conditioning coaches all over the place are. I mean, running is an activity that a lot of people love to do.
So. Yeah, you know, and as we've talked about before, and I've even posted this into my group, you know, running does not cause knee arthritis. You know, and the incidence of knee arthritis is very low in recreational runners compared to sedentary people. And you know, when we start seeing it become an issue is when you start seeing those ultra marathoners or high volume training at a consistent rate, because then it becomes an abnormal amount of stress on healthy tissue, and we know that that's a way that a body will break down. It can't adapt. There's too much load. You know, really, the recovery process is not meeting the demands of the body. So, you know, what we want to start to look at is just the activity of running itself, and. Everyone knows that we believe in strength training, you know, or resistance training, or whatever you choose to call it. You know, we need to create stronger muscles, which are going to create stronger tendons, which are going to produce more force, which is also going to allow you to elicit more power. You know, your rate of force development increases, you know, and that's going to be positive. And when we look at running economy, there are many research articles that prove that running economy improves with strength training. And we also know that, again, the likelihood of injuries decrease. Now, the type of modality that we need for injury prevention, again, you know, we can debate that a little bit. But even if I saw a 10% decrease in injury risk over the course of running, if you think about the number of foot contacts you actually take, that can be a pretty significant amount. So any chance that we have to decrease injuries, you know, really that should be, I don't want to say the priority, but that should be pretty high up on our list when it comes to training, you know, because if you have injuries, you can't train, you can't run, you can't do what you love. So this all works together. Now, we've touched upon before, Adam, with running, that running is very unique in that it's a north-south action. Now, the body doesn't just work in a north-south action. So, what are some muscle groups that you find are overdeveloped in runners?
Usually calves and quads.
Calves and quads. And if we think about where those muscles are related to the body, you know, they're on the front and the back. They control north-south action. You know, so I typically find, in depending on who the runner is and what foot strike they use, we may include hip flexors into that. And that may just be due to multiple reasons. I'm not sure why. Now, if you see or are there common muscular deficiencies that you see in runners?
Yeah, usually it's more often than not, it's glutes, lateral glutes. I don't know that it's necessary. I mean, it could be a hamstring deficiency when you talk about if somebody's really just nailing their quads with, you know, if they are strength training, but only focusing on, you know, the primary movers that they know they're using, their quads and their calves and stuff like that. I mean, theoretically, with hip extension, you're using the glutes regardless, but long-distance running, it's not something that people necessarily think as much about. Glutes are something that's much more focused on when you start talking about people that are looking to develop speed,
mm-hmm.
Because they are such explosive hip extensors. But I think more often than not, glutes, hamstrings, I think those are the two big ones.
Well, and you talked about the lateral glutes.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So why... Why are the lateral glutes, and for those of you who are listening in, when we say lateral glutes, we're talking about the glute medius specifically. That tends to be the one that everyone points to. Why is the glute med important for runners?
Because it affects hip stability. So yes, you're moving forward and back, but every time you pick up one foot and drop the other, your hips have the possibility. They move slightly up and down. I mean, if you were looking at it from the back, you would be looking at basically one butt cheek coming up and one butt cheek coming down. And if we don't have enough stability in the hips, then that's where we can run into issues down the line.
Yeah. So essentially, it sounds like you're talking more about they help control motion.
Right.
So, and that's, I'm glad you said that, because it that's typically what I find as well, you know, and people, especially females, tend to be more quad dominant to begin with. So then they start doing a lot of quad dominant exercises to build up their legs where they're already strong to begin with. And then they don't treat the posterior chain like they should. And then from there, it just becomes, okay, I'm really good at my bigger, stronger muscles, but the controllers can't fine tune the motion. And then they basically have to muscle through the run. And then eventually, again, we get abnormal amounts of stress onto our body. Now, what are some very good and efficient movement tests that you put runners through? And I know it's the same for everyone, but this will make more sense when I follow up with the next question.
Yeah, usually it's checking on how they can do in their single leg movements. It's do they have, essentially, what's their balance like? What's their ability to control force, whether it be a drop test, whether it just be like, how do they move when I ask them to do something like high knees.
Sure.
Like, can they actually get true hip flexion or, you know, calf movement, true mm-hmm. ankle movement, like true propulsion,
yeah,
that kind of stuff. It usually comes down to balance, because usually that balance in a single leg stance shows you whether or not those lateral glutes are strong or not.
Absolutely. You know, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because a lot of people, again, when they're training, they usually will do things like squatting or where both legs are on the ground, you know, but I like how you went right to single leg and I knew you were going to get there, because running is a single leg jumping exercise over and over again, you know, and people don't understand that. So I'm glad, and you kind of went right into my next question, because I was going to ask, well, what's the importance of the single leg stuff, but you explained that beautifully. Now, what are some common movement deviations that you'll tend to see and again, we're not just picking on runners. This show is about running. Mm-hmm. So what are some common impairments or common movement dysfunctions that you'll see in runners?
So usually, and I don't know if this is necessarily a dysfunction, but when you have a runner, people that are like more recreational runners, not the people that have, you know, worked with coaches and stuff like that, and they've really fine-tuned, and I'll explain kind of what I mean about that later, but there's a lot more efficiency of movement, I guess, when they train. You know, like, for example, we do, if we're doing like just like a high knee set, you know, just like some sort of metabolic thing, we're basically running in place. You know, the runners around the room, you won't see much like true hip flexion, you know, it's real small movements or stuff like that. Tight hand, in quotes, tight hamstrings. We've talked about multiple times why I put that in quotes, but
yep.
Hamstrings, you know, the oftentimes their ability to associate like one side to the other. If you ever get somebody who hasn't done a lot of work on actual form running, has just gone out and run, and then you come in and ask them to do a skip, usually, like, just that differentiation of exactly,
same
it's
arm,
the
same arm,
same leg. And it's funny because you'll say, like, well, would you go out and try and run like that? No, it's, I mean, and granted, I'm sure that, you know, I'm not a big long distance runner, but I'm sure that a lot of long distance running, you're not doing a ton of arm movement. I mean, it's a long distance, and doing that full arm movement for long periods of time, you're looking for conservation. But my point is that usually that differentiation from side to side is lacking.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the big ones I tend to find.
Yeah.
And, you know, just general tightness, calf tightness, hamstring tightness, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and unless someone really focuses on it, you know, I typically find that one side has an increased knee valgus compared to the other. That's another big one that I'll see. But again, that's going to be coming from more so the hip,
right,
more than anything. Tight ankles, you know, their ankle mobility is very limited. So again, that may also prevent them from recoiling back into dorsiflexion, may prevent them from getting complete plantar flexion. You never know. I mean, we just have to be able to look at that. But really, it goes back to the concept we've talked about before. Are all the joints that are movable actually moving the way they should? Do they have a freedom of motion? And then we have the stable points, like the knee and the low back, and that's really it for the... maybe the midfoot, because the midfoot needs to be a stable joint, because it needs to be able to control pronation and supination. But really, all the other points need to be very movable to allow for that natural elastic recoil. You know, I know there's different forms of running, you know, and you know, I've typically found that people that lean forward a little bit more, mm-hmm. not necessarily trunk flexion, but when they're utilizing hip extension and their trunk angle matches their hip extension, those are the ones that tend to be faster, but they mm-hmm. tend to increase their running economy too, you know. But now you get a lot of people still, you have to stay vertical. Well, that increases drag. So, and then it becomes more hip flexor dominant, because you're actually pulling your leg into the next step
mm-hmm.
instead of just a natural recoil. So I always try to look at single leg balance. Can they get into, you know, natural hip extension positions? You know, can they pull themselves back up like a single leg deadlift?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and I do check a squat, but usually my squat is just going to be, okay, what's my overall picture going to be of this person? You know, because we do know that looking at someone's squat can be indicative of their natural performance. So generally, people that squat better are better at performing at their given activity. So that's really where I begin with it. Now, for when you're designing a program for a runner,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know what I would pick, and we're probably going to be on the same page with this. What are some lower extremity exercises that you want them to focus on?
So, again, more single leg stuff. Single leg bridges are a good one. Single leg deadlifts. Lateral lunges, we've talked about that before, how important it is working into that lateral plane is for runners. Yes, I will. I like forward lunges. I know that, I don't know if maybe I'm just missing something, because nobody really talks about forward lunges that much. It's all about, you know, splits. I mean, not that split squats aren't, you know, awesome, and they're another single leg exercise, and you hear a lot about reverse lunges, split squats, but not a lot about forward lunges. The reason I like forward lunges so much is it's because it's teaching you to control momentum moving forward. It's all about deceleration and control. And if you've ever watched any sport, what is the injury that you always worry about? It's a non-contact injury. And non-contact might as well be deceleration. It's whenever a player is changing directions and something buckles, or they're coming out of a sprint and they're trying to slow down and look for the ball or whatever, and something buckles.
Mm-hmm.
It's all deceleration. If you don't have the ability to strongly decelerate your body weight, I mean, you know, it's a little bit different when you're working at speeds of, you know, 20 miles an hour, like an NFL wide receiver can run, but still, I mean, you know, granted, and then it comes down to the individual. If I'm working with somebody that's been doing nothing but lunges and, you know, squat jumps for the last 2 years, and maybe I'm not going heavy on the squat jumps and stuff. I'm working more on the single leg deadlifts or the, you know, I also like hamstring curls, stuff like that. Stuff that, again, all works towards the deceleration, where they've been working on acceleration. Quads, calves, forward movement, acceleration. So I'm worried more about the deceleration and the lateral movement.
Sure. So let's just go back to squat jumps for a minute.
Yep.
How often do you find that runners are actually performing jump squats?
I've never really thought about it before, to be honest with you, but probably not that often.
Not enough, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, not enough.
So can you just kind of take the listeners through what is a jump squat, mm-hmm. and what are the benefits of it in general, and then why it would benefit a runner?
So it's kind of a similar reason to the lunges. It's all about learning to create force and also absorb force, or control force, however you want to put it. So squat jump, basically imagine that you're setting up in a body weight squat position, so feet about hip width apart, maybe with a slight toe turnout depending on your hip mobility, all that crap, whatever. Butt down, jump up, and landing soft. And that's the big part, is landing soft. Landing soft meaning like no noise, you're controlling it down onto your joints. Again, this is, there's a line. They're the people that you watch do squat jumps and they land and you hear it from across the gym and you're like, ugh, and you kind of like cringe a little bit.
Yeah, and those are the ones that are typically slamming their heels into
exactly,
the ground.
Exactly, yep.
So when Adam's talking about landing softly, with a vertical jump, you're generally going to land on the balls of your feet first, mm-hmm. and you softly land into your heels.
Right.
And that actually loads you into your next jump. It creates an elastic recoil. So it's called the stretch shortening cycle. Now, what I like about the jump squat, and we'll get into the benefits to runners, is one, they're working on that explosive extension between the knees and the hips. But what I also like is it's building, again, power for these runners, which again, if they just do traditional strength training, they're probably not optimizing their type 2B muscle fibers. So give me two main reasons why you want runners to do jumping, or what we also call plyometrics.
So basically being able to control that stretch shortening cycle, because that is a huge part of running that people don't tend to necessarily think about. They don't think about the fact that they're basically doing a power exercise every time they land and push off again.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and then it's just, for me, it comes back to creating power and being able to control power.
So power, and that's why I like the plyometrics. Generally, if you're just working on your muscular endurance and your cardiorespiratory fitness, let's say you come up to a hill,
mm-hmm.
that's only going to take you so far.
Yeah.
Your muscles need to be able to generate force.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, because you don't get that natural elastic recoil on a hill.
Right.
Gravity's throwing you backwards. So you have to have a certain amount of power to generate speed up a hill. I know a lot of people that they actually throttle down when they get to a hill.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, stay on your toes, lean forward, spring. And then when you get to the top of the hill, you'll be able to start going. Or if you go back down the hill, then the only problem is you have to control it eccentrically.
Right.
So that's why I like plyometrics for runners. Now, I apologize for keep putting you on the spot, but all these questions keep popping up. I didn't plan on this ahead of time. Now, let's say a runner comes in. My knee is bothering me. I can't do a jump squat today. What are some examples of other plyometric exercises that you like to perform with pretty much anyone, but something that a runner could do?
Lat. You could do like little things, depending on how bad we're talking. Little things like, I call them pogos, whatever, calf bounces,
mm-hmm.
Just like feet together, flicking the ground away. So you're just getting that little bit of, foot-toe extension, but you're also getting a little bit of plyometric and you have to land that. And it's actually pretty close to what you have to do with running. It's just 2 feet versus one. Skaters, hide and jumps, whatever you want to call it. Just essentially side-to-side single leg jumps. You start off on one leg, you start off on your left leg, you push to the right and you land on your right leg. Like mm-hmm. just simple stuff like that. Doesn't have to be super super far. If they're depending on where they're at, and this is a little bit more of an it depends territory, but if their knees are sore, if the takeoff from the jump doesn't hurt but the landing is what hurts, maybe like a short box jump, so they don't have to create a ton of force, but they're landing. Like, people don't tend to realize that box jumps have kind of gotten a bad rap because some people use them in unintended purposes, or people are stupid with them and stack up four boxes, so it's a 54-inch box jump. But realistically, what they do is they allow you to work on your creating power, but then you don't have to worry. You can work on the landing without having to land with absorbing a ton of force.
Yeah.
So like maybe a short box jump, something like that, where the landing isn't creating a ton of force. They can land nice and soft with less force, but they're still working on that stretch shortening cycle in some forms by having to jump onto the box.
Sure, absolutely. Now, what are your thoughts on like med ball slams for producing power?
Yep. I mean, you do stuff like that too. I do it a little bit more so in my smaller class just because of the room we have for that. But yeah, basically same idea. Like you start with the med ball in the middle, feet are parallel, come right up onto those toes and snap the ball, you know, like a snake snapping. I can't think of a better way to put it, but it's the way I kind of think about it.
Just trying to throw the ball through the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, so you create power that way. You can do lateral throws, all kinds of stuff.
You know, and even I've gone as far as if someone doesn't physically want to leave the ground, doing something like a speed deadlift or a speed squat or just something to generate, again, more of that communication between the nerve and the muscle. Because really what it comes down to is we just want to create neuromuscular efficiency.
Right.
You know, this muscle needs the work. Boom, I can make it work. I can produce that power. You know, and this is just to illustrate there are many examples that we can use to produce power. So, you know, you're not limited to just jumping. You're not limited to just lunges. There are many exercises that are out there, but I'm also with you on the forward lunge that you talked about. Walking lunges, I think, are fantastic because that really illustrates, it really shows us how if we let momentum get ahead of us, you know, it's just going to keep us going and we generally can't control it, you know, and that's really what this all comes down to is, you know, the north-south muscles end up doing too much of the work. The east-west muscles can't do enough to control it, and that becomes really the biggest issue, especially when you're hitting the pavement, you know, 5,000, 7,000, 10,000 times, whatever it may be, or people that have higher mileage where they're running, you know, 30, 50, 70 miles a week.
Right.
You know, those smaller muscles just, they go on vacation like everything else. You know, it's kind of like sitting, where our bigger, stronger muscles pull us into that bad position, the smaller stabilizers can't control it, and then they become less efficient. So really, it's a matter of just increasing efficiency. Now, we talked about the glute med before.
Mm-hmm.
If you had to pick one exercise for the glute med or the lateral glute that you think is, one, dumb, and then one that you think is probably the most functional for runners, what would they be?
I'm sorry, I started laughing because 30 seconds before you started this question, I was thinking about making a joke about clamshells. Like, as soon as you said that, I'm like, there is no way that he's literally saying that right now. So yes, one of the ones that I think is overused that I think shouldn't be used as much are clamshells. Honestly, just because it's not super functional. I mean, you're never... When you're doing that motion is designed to strengthen those hip muscles so that theoretically when your foot hits the ground, they're more stable. When you're doing clamshells, your foot isn't on the ground. It's one of those kind of, in my opinion, one of those classic misconceptions of functional anatomy versus anatomy. Or what do you, I mean, do you just call it anatomy? Like if you're comparing it to functional anatomy?
Regular biomechanics.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So, for that, though, what I do like, and I've talked about it before, single leg deadlifts, Palloff presses, things that force those lateral hip muscles to work, but in a functional way that they would theoretically in a real world environment. And a single leg deadlift is a big time one.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, when you're running, there's very little time that you're actually, I don't know if you're ever really on 2 feet.
It's a single leg phase and there's a floating phase.
Right. I mean, if you think about it, a single leg, if you're like an active runner, and by active, I mean you're not just, and I have this later on, but when I'm talking about active versus passive running, I tend to think of active runners are the people that when their foot hit the ground, they're almost like they're trying to pull their foot back. They're propelling themselves forward, whereas the passive runner is the person that kind of picks up their foot but just kind of falls forward onto that foot and then picks up the other foot and just kind of falls forward onto it. If you think of an active runner, like somebody that's actually trying to pull the ground away, pull back as they propel themselves forward. It's very similar to what a single leg deadlift actually is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the foot stays fixed, but if you think about the movement mechanics as they're pulling themselves back up, if you kept the hips where they were and instead moved the leg, it would be almost the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. So single leg deadlifts, that kind of thing, are what I like personally.
Yeah, and I'm not saying the clamshell is the worst thing in the world. I just think it's dumb for runners.
Yeah.
You know, if we had a 75-year-old woman who was sedentary and she had hip bursitis and she needed to re-strengthen her glute med, I'm willing to start there with the goal of getting her into a functional activity.
Right.
But if you take some of these high-level athletes that you see and they're doing clamshells because no one has taught them differently, you know, that makes me want to vomit a little bit, because that's not what we should be doing. We need to keep it functional. You know, I even like having them just do sidestepping with a band around their ankle. You know, I think that's a great exercise, just because it's going to work on the glute med. Now, the one thing I don't necessarily like is when people bend their knees and their hips too much. You know, kind of like they're guarding someone in basketball.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't want necessarily a side shuffle.
Yeah.
You know, I want more of a side step. So I actually like them having be a little bit more vertical, keep the hips underneath them.
Yeah.
Don't utilize the hip flexors when the glute med should be working for you. So I teach it a little bit different, but I really think that it pays a lot of dividends, you know, and then that way you can also pair other things in with it. You know, then start doing a Palloff press with a sidestep. I think those are very beneficial for runners. Even if someone's doing a lunge and putting a band around their front leg so it tries to pull their knee into an inward force and now their muscles have to reactively stabilize, I still think those are far more efficient. And these can be used as what I call facilitation exercises. So if they come in and they're going to be doing a strength training session with you, these are very easy exercises that they can do beforehand just to turn on those muscles, or they can be fillers in between sets. So if you have them doing a heavy set of squats or lunges or whatever it may be, and then they have a minute break, you know, all right, do some Palloff press on a single leg.
Yep.
You know, so they're still going to let that first body part recover, but now they're still working to build up muscular endurance and control. So now, are there any other notable aspects about movement dysfunctions or inefficiencies that you see with runners that we haven't covered before we get into the region-specific stuff?
Looking ahead at what we have, not really any that I can think of that we aren't kind of working our way towards. So I don't know. Did you have any others in mind? I mean, most of the big ones have talked about, or that I can think of.
No, we covered that pretty extensively. We covered it probably a little bit more than I originally anticipated, but that's good. You know, it's all about education.
Right.
So, all right. So now we're going to transition into some of the more common injuries that we'll see, and you know, this is no different from my PT standpoint compared to your strength and conditioning standpoint. You and I probably see people at the same rate. Actually, you probably see more people with this stuff than I do, because generally people aren't coming in until you refer them or it becomes bad and it's limiting what they can do. So you actually probably see this on a more prevalent time frame. Now, knee soreness is usually something that we always see. And oftentimes people hear the terms, oh, I have patellofemoral pain syndrome. It's a blanketed term. You know, patellofemoral means kneecap on femur, and then pain syndrome. So it tells us where the pain is. Now, there was a research study that showed people with patellofemoral pain syndrome generally have weaker hip muscles. The glute med is generally weaker as well. So that right there, I check the glute med. Is it weak? Is there tissue, tendon stuff? And we'll talk about the specific condition in a moment. But another research article that I thought was very interesting is that generally the hip muscles work better when someone has a stable core.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to us, makes perfect sense. But then you have people that don't train their core, that don't train their hips, and they just go out and they start running and they let running be their training. They still need to do these other things to make running more efficient.
Yeah.
So
can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
When somebody refers, how do you, what, how do I put this? What section of the body do you define as your core? Because I know that for me, this is different than the way a lot of people tend to think about it.
Well, if a lot of people, the common way that people go about defining the core is generally going to be your transverse abdominis, so mm-hmm. the deep core muscles that basically are surrounding the spine. Then the definition went to, all right, it's going to be your global stabilizers, which are also going to be basically anything from your rib cage to your pelvis.
Yeah.
But the newest definition of core, and for me, this is the one I go by, it's basically any muscular attachment that attaches to the axial skeleton, mm-hmm. even if it also attaches to the appendicular, so meaning something that attaches to your arm or legs.
Yeah.
So with that said, that also means that our hamstrings
yep.
are going to be part of it, because the hamstrings are part of, attached to the ischial tuberosity, which is on the pelvis. It also means your quads, because they attach to the front portion of the pelvis. We can even start to look at it. Your lats
yep.
are also going to be part of your core. So my definition of core far exceeds what most people go by.
Okay. Yep.
But that also explains why I'm so big on teaching full body exercises where we're incorporating arm and leg movement.
Yeah.
Because now we're trying to transfer the force from the ground when your foot hits the ground into the extremity. You know, and with baseball pitchers, it's easier to see. You know, a right-handed pitcher, the left leg goes forward, hits the ground, and then we have to transfer the force through the core and then through the right arm.
Yeah.
So I just like, I like teaching people how to use reciprocal arm and leg swing.
Yep.
Because the core has to control all of that. So yep. Do you have any definition?
No,
different
so
definition?
I've always, since college, I had, I don't remember who it was, a professor or something that put it this way. And ever since then, that's how I've always, because it makes these, I tend to think of core as the shoulders to, as the knees to the shoulders.
Yep.
Because everything else moves around that, but like you said, everything attached, you know, your quads and everything attached to the knee, they also attach to the hip. And so, like, when you say core, that's what I think of. But I know when some people say core, they just think of, like, you know, essentially your rectus abdominis, the front
the
and
beach
the back.
Muscles.
And, right, exactly.
And typically have people doing planks and side planks and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
Which again, are not bad exercises to do. And Stuart McGill, the spine biomechanist from Canada, showed that the side plank can be a very effective exercise. It stabilizes the spine a lot, but and puts the least amount of stress on it. You know, and he also showed that with the curl up and the bird dog exercise. So at the very least, that's a very safe place to start.
Yep.
Are they the most functional?
Depends. Yeah.
Debatable.
Yeah.
Debatable. I'd rather get someone up and do some other things like a push pull or something along those lines. You know, even just doing a band pull down. I mean, even just if you went out to the ski ergs in the gym, kept your spine vertical and just pulled with your arms, that shows you perfectly how your core has to tighten before your arms even have to move.
Right.
There's an anticipatory control, and we lose that control when we're injured. So if you feel pain, then those muscles can't for a split second protect everything before your arms even move. You know that, and that always amazes me that. You know, if I think about going to touch this microphone, before I even move my hand, my core is already tightening, you know, which is kind of the cool part. So running, if we have an inefficient core, it has to disperse the stress somewhere else. And again, for a lot of us, it's just going to travel down the chain.
Right.
So if we have an inefficient core, which then leads to hip weakness, we can't control the knee, then it becomes a knee problem. That's where we're coming back to patellofemoral pain syndrome. Yep. The way they used to treat patellofemoral pain syndrome is that it used to be a mal-tracking problem, meaning the kneecap wasn't tracking the right way. It used to be VMO weakness. You know, strengthen the VMO and you'll be fine. Fucking newsflash, you cannot isolate one part of the quadricep. Now, what we need are exercises that put more stress to the VMO. And the way we do that is by picking exercises that bend the knee to 90 degrees or greater. Now, what are we told not to do with our knees?
Bend to 90 degrees or
holy
greater.
Holy shit!
Or, I should say past 90.
Yeah, past 90. Yeah. Don't squat past 90. Holy shit, why not? We were made to do that. And we have the research to prove the VMO has its highest rate of EMG activity, so electromyography, with movements that are at 90 degrees of knee flexion or deeper. Does that mean squatting down to our normal 125, 130, or even 140? So we just have to debunk all of that. Now we have to consider that the kneecap is not the problem, but everything else. So before we used to say, oh, the train is the problem. Well, now we have to start considering the actual track is the problem. You know, and that's when we start getting in soft tissue problems, tendinopathies, whatever it may be. Typically, I find with the knee pain, we'll either see it directly above the kneecap, so in the quad tendon, or directly below in the patellar ligament. And it always baffled me. And even early in my career, it's like, all right, if we treat the tendon, if we treat the ligament, we're treating the pain. We still did not change what was pulling on it to begin with.
Yeah, that's always confused me too, because like the more I think about it, I mean, a tendon, a ligament, a tendon, and bone really can't, I mean, it can slightly, but it really can't adjust its...
length.
Length, right. So then why... I don't even want to necessarily get off on that, because I'm sure that could be a long talk. But I just don't quite understand why it would ever have been the assumption that the structures that can't change their length are the problem versus the ones that can.
Easy thing to look at. I mean, especially take females, for example, they have an increased valgus or inward stress of the knee.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the kneecap's not going to stay inwards. You elicited a strong contraction of the vastus lateralis. It's going to track laterally.
Right.
You know, and unless someone has stability issues where it actually dislocates or subluxes.
Well, right, of course.
It's not going to be a major issue. You know, but think about how they treat tendon problems to begin with.
Yeah,
you know,
they
just treat the site. They haven't thought of, you know, what actually pulls on it. You know, muscle has a great ability to absorb stress and pass it along to the tendon. Well, what happens when the muscle gets to a point it can no longer do that? It's going to max itself out lengthwise and circumferentially, so 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's going to pass that force to the tendon, which can't do the same thing.
Right.
So then you start getting the micro trauma in the tendon,
right,
which then also pulls on the bone and creates sensitivity, potentially inflammation. So it's like, yes, you can treat that area, but if you don't treat the other 80% of the cause,
right,
it's going to come right back. And that's... think of running over and over again. It's a high rate of stress on the body. You know, and you think about the quad position, you know, we're going to have some shortening of the hip flexor. So the quad contributes to that. And then we also see some knee extension or knee flexion, which lengthens it down here. And then it just becomes repetitive stress or eccentric loading. So we get some thickening of the tendon. It can't disperse the force as well as it should. It becomes too stiff. Then the kneecap will actually rise up in the trochlear groove. I'll just call it socket for a lack of a better term. And this is millimeters. It's not like it's dislocated. But then that throws off the biomechanics of the knee. It doesn't ride in the trochlear groove as much. And then if it pulls north by 2 millimeters, that means the patellar ligament has to get pulled on by 2 millimeters, and the ligament doesn't stretch.
Right.
You know. So then we just get to the point of a stress failure. You know, and then that we get to the point where we've overloaded it and it starts causing pain, inflammation, whatever it may be. Now, if we merely just looked at the middle of the quadricep, where generally that common trigger point is going to be in all of us, that usually is going to be the fix. And the same can be said for Achilles tendonitis, plantar fasciitis, which is further down our list. You know, and then once we've loosened everything up, then you can start strengthening.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I have a knee valgus, I'm going to strengthen the hip. Well, if you have a fucked up quad,
right,
then all you're doing is just layering that strength on the dysfunctional quad.
Right.
And then that creates more movement compensations down the road. Now, again, to remind everyone, I am not a runner. I don't claim to be and I don't want to be. I run and I understand the mechanics of it, you know, but Adam and I can also look at people that have efficient movement. So I can appreciate runners that are very efficient.
Oh, yeah.
So we're purely talking about this from a movement standpoint. It doesn't take a genius to look at someone and know when someone's a bad runner, you know? So that's we want to help identify those individuals that can use these efficiencies. Now, one thing I found with this knee soreness in runners, you know, patellofemoral pain syndrome, and you've probably noticed this as well, when their painful leg is in a lunge position, specifically when the painful leg is their back leg, they'll have pain, but when it's the front leg, they won't. Well, that's because we're shortening the quadricep at the hip.
Yep.
And then it's potentially getting lengthened at the knee, but only for a split second because you're coming into standing. When it's the back leg, it's getting constantly lengthened at the hip, lengthened at the knee. And then when they go further down to the ground, they're potentially using hip extension.
Right.
And then it just pulls the kneecap further up. So we have to loosen that up, you know. So foam rolling. It's the easiest way to go about it.
Can I transition into the next? Well, not the next, but one thing. So you're talking about quad tightness. And I think that a lot of people don't realize that just because it's a it's the opposite side. So if you have super tight quads, you're going to run into hamstring issues too.
Correct.
And a lot of people, like, it doesn't, you know, you'll see people that are running a lot, and what are they constantly rolling? More often than not, it's their hamstrings. Oh, my hamstrings are so tight. My hamstrings hurt. I need to roll them. I need to stretch them. When realistically, the problem may not be, well, I'm not even going to say may not. More often than not, the problem isn't the hamstring. It's, you know, any number of things, but one of them can be that the quad is so tight that it's actually, your body is essentially, if you try to bend that knee under tension, your hamstring can cramp up just because your body is like, nope, you can't stretch that quad anymore in that direction, so we're going to stop you from bending that knee anymore. Or, you know, the quads and the hip flexors tip the pelvis forward. And we've talked in the past about how if the pelvis tips forward, the hamstring is already pre-stretched. So if the front side is tipping the pelvis forward because it's so tight, and then you're pre-stretching the hamstring, and then you're running 15 miles like that, then yeah, of course your hamstring is going to be tight. It's going to be sore. But it's kind of counterintuitive to think, oh, I got to roll my quad so that my hamstring feels better. But that could actually be a huge part of the reason why.
Absolutely. I mean, even just teaching people how to facilitate their glutes.
Right.
Their butt muscles help with hamstring pain because now the hamstring doesn't have to work as a knee flexor, hip extensor.
Yep.
It's a primary knee flexor, secondary hip extensor. But when your butt muscles go on vacation, it now becomes primary knee flexor, primary hip extensor. And that's why people get hamstring cramps.
Yep.
You know, and if people haven't noticed, you usually get cramps in muscles that cross two or more joints. So it never happens in a one joint muscle.
Yep.
You know, so it takes on too much work and then it yells at you.
Yep.
So, and we need to recognize that. So you mentioned on the hamstring tightness. Now, one thing that I see people doing, and you, everyone knows we love foam rolling. What is your preferred method for self-massaging the hamstring?
For me, it's probably foam rolling or some sort of hand, like a tiger tail hand rolling, something like that. It depends. So like we've talked before about, you know, if it's closer to the knee, sometimes I like doing some of those, you know, like lacrosse ball leg extensions for, I don't know if there's a technical name for them, but like putting the lacrosse ball basically at the end of the hamstring behind the leg and then just straightening the leg out, stuff like that. But I mean, and I'm not sure if I'm going off, you know, in another direction. I don't want to, like, you can bring me back. But I more often than not am spending time pretty much anywhere else other than the hamstring first.
Yeah, I don't do much to the hamstring.
Yeah, me neither.
But my preferred method is that pin and stretch that you just described. Sit on top of the ball and then start to lengthen. You know, really the big key is we want to dig through the tissue. And sometimes I just find that, unfortunately, the foam roller is too big. And the surface area of the hamstring is larger. Yeah. So what you need is actually a smaller object to actually dig through. So I'll always tell people, you know, sit on your kitchen chair with a lacrosse ball underneath, you know, push down on the area where the ball is, and then straighten your leg five times. So I typically find it hurts like a bastard, but it's very, very effective.
Yeah.
But yeah, with the hamstring, I don't do too much. Generally, I fix the quad, I strengthen the glutes, and generally the hamstring fixes itself, which is good. Now, another common one that we'll see, plantar fasciitis, again, when we look at the entire kinetic chain, there are multiple things that can happen. But when there's usually two big risk factors that are associated with plantar fasciitis, what do you think those are?
I would say, well, tight calves, tight calves, tight hips. I'm just thinking, like, if your calves aren't moving, you're not getting full plantar and dorsiflexion, and if your hips aren't strong, then you could fall into valgus and fall into your arches, essentially.
So that's another risk factor, but even make it more simple than that. Tight calves,
yeah.
Limited ankle range of motion.
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah.
So when that happens, and generally it's when the foot hits the ground, you know, and we have to remember that low arches and high arches both pose a problem. Mm-hmm. With low arches, there's not enough support, so then they end up just kissing the ground with the plantar fascia. It can't support anything. With high arches, there's too much support. There's not enough shock absorption, so you end up crashing into the plantar fascia, and then we cause microtrauma. So one is not better than the other. Now, what we have to recognize is when the body cannot go through dorsiflexion, it's going to try to cheat. And generally, we'll start to see an exorbitant amount of pressure being placed on the plantar fascia, whether that's because dorsiflexion can't be produced, so the rear foot collapses down, like with pronation. We may also see the midfoot will collapse down as well, you know, whether it's too much or not enough, but then also not enough great toe extension. I think that is a very underlooked area. You know, anytime someone comes in, especially with lower extremity stuff, even if it's a low back, you know, I come down, I wiggle their kneecaps, and people are like, what are you doing that for? Well, if it's very stiff when you're lying here, that means the quad is overworking. Then I'll usually just give a quick spring of the calf just to feel the tissue resistance, and then I bend back their big toes, and they're like, what the hell are you doing that for? Well, I want to see, are you getting full toe extension? You know, and for an average person, we want 50 degrees, ideally 70. With a runner, we'd want to see up to 90. And I just have seen so many people that have either turned their foot out because they pronate, or have turned their foot out because the only way they can dorsiflex is by pronation. They roll off the bone of the big toe, yep, and they don't great toe extend at all. So that's an area that I think a lot of people can improve upon, you know, and really just, you know, sitting back on your heels. So you're on the ground on your knees, sitting back on your heels with your feet tucked under you, mm-hmm, is an easy way to work on toe mobility. You know, even putting your big toe against the wall like a calf stretch is another great way to work on it. So I just think all those things taken together can really help plantar fascia. You know, plus we have to remember the repetitive stress because our foot hits the ground every single day. You got to roll the tissue to get fresh blood flow in there.
Yep.
And it takes time. You know, again, all of these tendons, ligaments, things that have poor vascular supply, blood flow, it can take 12 to 14 weeks because you have to break down the tissue. There's got to be some sort of cell turnover, and then your body basically has to repair and remodel itself. So, you know, it's uber important to make sure that we're creating an environment that our body can continually heal while still doing the activities that we're supposed to do. So, but I just think there's a lot of misinformation out there. Or then you have the other end of the spectrum that just says, I'm just going to keep running through it. It'll get better. You know, and then that layers another level of compensation on top of compensation. And then by the time they see you with those four layers of compensation, now they have pain in multiple places. And then that's when you end up sending them to me. You know, and our goal is, can we stop this before they even get here?
Right.
You know, can they do these things 5 minutes before they work out with you? You know, can they just add this into their warm-up to prevent this from occurring? And I would say yes. It's consistency. Right. That's the important part. Do they have to do it year-round? Maybe some variation of it, but, you know, it's kind of like when we were talking about designing our own programs. You know, we always try to add too much. You know, we know all this stuff, so it's like, oh, we need to add this in, we need to add that in. You know, for runners, you know, strength training could be as simple as, all right, let's do a forward lunge, let's do a single leg deadlift, let's do sidestepping with a resistance band, and let's do a pal-off press. Four exercises, maybe you do 2-3 sets a piece, you can get that done in 6 minutes.
Right.
You know? And that can be put in the workout program. And then if someone said, all right, I want to do foam rolling, what do you recommend? Well, roll the bottom of your foot, roll your calf, roll your quad. You know, if you want to get into the glutes, that's fine. But we really didn't talk about that too much today. And then people will say, well, what about stretching? Now, when we look at the research that talks about stretching, stretching does not actually prevent injuries. When we look at injury prevention rates, does that mean we shouldn't stretch? No. When there's an impairment side to side, I'm certainly fine with it. Plus, for a lot of people, we have to look at stretching as kind of calming down the nervous system. Mm-hmm. So if that allows people to stretch for 5 minutes and they can be in the moment and they can relax, I'm all for it. You know, and it doesn't matter if we stretch right before, right after, 8 hours later, as long as we do it, that's the important part. All right, so we talked about how can we affect change for these issues. So we've talked about how strength training can really prevent injuries, but it improves running economy. Mm-hmm. You know, we just gave the example of what we can do for strength training. Now, for a runner, how many days a week do you think they should be focusing on these strength training exercises?
I would say three-ish. Around three.
Yeah,
I mean, it depending on how many, at least two.
Yeah, I'd say two is the absolute minimum.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
You have to take into account their running volume and are they
right.
In season or off season. You know, in season, two. Off season, three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then probably more full body stuff if it is their off season. So I certainly recommend that. You know, and then once we start getting to the nuances of plyometrics and things like that, I don't want to confuse the listeners today. And if you had to pick a number of days where you'd say, do your stretching, do your foam rolling X number of days, and this will be enough for you, what have you found that sweet spot to be?
I mean, the more you can, the better. But if you can get 3 or 4 days in, I'm usually like, I will be happy with that.
Yeah, and I think three is a safe number.
Yeah.
Ideally, we're doing it the same number of days that we're working out because you don't have to do it that long, and that's another misconception of it too.
Right.
You know, in the beginning, if someone's injured, I always tell them we have to front load it, but then the goal is to back off. The goal is to find the smallest amount with the maximum benefit.
Right.
You know, and I generally find 2-3 days a week doing it for 5 to 10 minutes is really enough. You know, I like doing this stuff every single day. But I'm not working on the same body parts every day.
Right.
You know, so I usually have 2 or 3 main body parts per day that I focus on. And then if they're feeling good, then I'll go back to other areas. But, you know, like today I'll go home and I'll work on hips and calves. Tomorrow I usually do my mid-back. And every week is a little bit different, but my focus is going to be a little bit different. You know, I like the pain. I mean, I think it tells me a lot. It sounds weird. I like the feeling of it. Helps me relax. So I don't expect people to do it every day like I do, but I think, you know, 2-3 days a week for the foam rolling, 3 days a week off season for strength training, 2 for in season, I think is a great place to start for runners that you can get them through their running season, you know, and it should really be as simple as that. So, all right. Is there anything else that you think, the listeners need to know?
Nah, I mean, we didn't get to touch too much on like the IT band stuff, but we've talked about that in other
we'll podcasts include that. Yeah,
too.
We can touch upon that next week.
Yeah. All right. Other than that, do you have anything else you want to talk about or?
No. This was a good session. We talked a lot. Hopefully, you guys got a lot. Next week's episode, we'll talk about strength training for hikers. You know, even though there's still a lot of single leg stuff that goes on with hiking, there's a slight nuance to the training that should be done just due to the effect of having to go uphill and down versus fatigue as well. And it's not as easy to train hiking in the off season. So we'll talk about that. I think that's it. But again, if you guys have any thoughts on sports that you want us to cover or general activities, you know, feel free to reach out. Once the podcast is up, you know, Adam has his email. So if you have any questions for us, there's also going to be the link to my Facebook group. So tonight I have Ask Ross Anything. I usually do that every 2 weeks now. I just give people time to hurt themselves or think up questions. But really, you just sign in, ask your question, and I give you guys some ideas of what to look at. There's also the link from my WellEvate page. So if anyone's interested in supplementation, just feel free to ask, and I can give you some recommendations. But other than that, I think we covered a lot. And until next time, take care of yourself.
Later, guys.